Welcome back to South Florida Arts Beat here on 91.3 WLRN and 91.5 WKWM. Ed Bell with you. Later on the show, jazz bassist Christian McBride talks about his career and his upcoming concert for South Florida Jazz with our music contributor, Chris DeAngelis. Chef Norman Van Aken renders a word on food, and our arts calendar today features Deborah Margol, Deputy Director of the Miami-Dade County Department of Cultural Affairs. Now, we welcome back to the show the country's preeminent jazz TV and event producer, Larry Rosen, to discuss his long career promoting America's music and the upcoming season for Miami-Dade County's most successful jazz series, the 7th annual Jazz Roots. Larry Rosen, welcome back to South Florida Arts Beat.
Well, thank you so much, Ed. What a pleasure.
It's such an honor to have you join us here as we were speaking earlier off mic. You have had such an exceptional career in music and particularly in jazz. Event after event after event, you came up as a musician. You met your friend Dave Grusin while at the Manhattan School of Music. You guys got together the Grusin-Rosen Productions and really started taking off with, I assume, your first artist, John Lucien. What a magnificent vocalist. And on, you were the first to digitally record a non-classical album in 1979 of Dave Grusin's Mountain Dance. I remember that recording. We played the heck out of it here in South Florida. And then in 1982, you established GRP Records, and that really took off. Did you expect such a reception for GRP back then in the early 80s?
Not really. I mean, I didn't know what to expect. You know, when you just love the music and you want to record great artists, you just go for it. You know, you don't know exactly what's going to happen. You just take a shot. It's only in retrospect you ever really understand what really took place.
Well, you became Billboard Magazine's number one contemporary jazz label for 5 consecutive years, and your artists were nominated for over 80 Grammy Awards, winning 33. That's phenomenal. Has any other jazz label ever done that? I don't think so.
I don't know. It was a remarkable time. There's no question about it. It was a time of a lot of invention was going on. You know, if we look back in jazz and the jazz history, you see at certain points certain things happen, and then they kind of follow a trend for a while, and then something new happens again, and then it follows a trend. And this was just a remarkable time period during the late 70s and 80s. It was the merging of rock and fusion music, right, and R&B and jazz and Latin, and bringing it all together. So we were right there when it was happening.
You had your feet in so many different areas of the jazz world, certainly mainstream jazz. You had, for instance, Diane Shore, and she was doing great mainstream stuff.
Right.
Patti Austin bringing a little pop tinge,
right,
R&B tinge to her wonderful jazz expressions. You were able to release recordings of Mac Rebennack, the great Dr. John,
right,
full of Louisiana sounds and Cajun gumbo and all of that. You got into smooth jazz, Spiro Gyra, the Rippingtons, David Benoit, Tom Scott. I mean, these were bona fide musicians. It just wasn't an instrumental pop thing.
Right.
It was heavily jazz soaked. So was all this just happenstance or calculated?
Well, calculated from the point of view that both Dave and I love this music, you know, and our scope is really wide. Because don't forget, at this exact same time, Dave was doing a lot of motion pictures and television shows. Mm. So he was dealing with all kinds of different music because different things are demanded by different, you know, movie scores. And of course, he was a great orchestrator. So he was writing, you know, almost symphonic kind of pieces at the same time. So from a musical spectrum, it was everything from straight ahead jazz to Latin tinge to funk to, you know, orchestral components to it, to taking a singer like Diane and recording her with the Count Basie Band, and another time recording her with Stan Getz with a rhythm section and strings. Mm-hmm. So it was all over the place.
Now, what possessed you to sell GRP Records in what to me looked like the apex of the label in, what, about 1990, you sold it to Universal Music Group, but you remained as president and CEO.
Right. Well, what happened was when, you know, Dave and I, when we first started as musicians working together, we actually started working for a singer, Andy Williams, and we traveled all around the world, played television shows and everything. And then once he started doing film scores and writing for all kinds of other artists, and I started to get involved in production, and we started with John Luciani and then Patty Austin and Lee Ritenour and then Angela Bofill and Dave Valentine. You know, we started to just be freelance producers making records. And then we met Clive Davis at Arista, and he said, why don't you guys do something together here? Why don't you, we want to give you a home here. And that's where we came up with GRP, and it was called Arista GRP. Mm-hmm. And we did a lot of records there, and one record we did with a young trumpet player named Tom Brown, a song called Funkin' for Jamaica.
Took off.
Just exploded. Yeah. You know, people like Marcus Miller and all these young kind of R&B-ish kind of jazz players, and the record became sold like a million units. It was like the number one R&B record, number one jazz record. It was just huge. And this was all part of this changing structure of what was happening in music, and it was really exciting. And then technology was changing at the same time. Mm-hmm. And Dave and I were always into sound quality, and we used to tour Japan a lot, and we learned in Japan about the first compact disc players that were going to come to the United States. And we said, wow, why don't we start recording digitally and put out compact discs, where nobody else was doing it at that particular point. And we moved right into that direction. Being a small, nimble company with two creative guys, you know, running it, you could do whatever you want.
You got a lot of criticism for that. I remember at a Jazz Times convention up in New York, people were just learning about this new technology, particularly in the national jazz world.
Exactly. I mean, you know, technology, every time it comes about in some new format is ready to take place, there's all these people say, oh, you know, what do we need that for? I mean, we have LPs, that's good enough, right? Or we have cassettes, or we have whatever it is, you know. And it just, in general, people seem to resist change for whatever reason, rationale. Certainly big companies do, because they're invested in the old format, whatever it is, so they don't want to make a change. So it's usually entrepreneurs that have to kind of have the vision for what it is and then believe in it and go after it. And that's just what we did. So when we saw that this new technology, all digital technology coming in and the compact disc, we said, look, why don't we separate from Arista and just be GRP, the digital master company? And we came up with a phrase, you know, a key marketing phrase, and we started doing that. When we, you know, there were no compact disc manufacturing plants in America at that point. We used to have to import the CDs that we would make. We'd send the masters to Japan, have them pressed in Japan, and bring them back to the United States. It would take about a month between the orders.
And what expenses, too. Sure.
And by the time we got it back, they were all sold out already. So we'd have to order it again. So first time we ordered 3,000, then 5,000, then 20,000, then 50,000, then 100,000. It was crazy. I mean, how the thing, there was such a demand for it. Even the retailers, Tower Records, wasn't going to sell compact discs because it didn't fit in their bins. It was too small. So it was being sold in stereo stores that were selling CD players. They needed products, so they had GRP CD. So, I mean, it was a remarkable time, you know. And your question is, why in 1990 did we decide to sell the company? Because by the time 1990 came, every other company was replicating what we were doing. Mm-hmm. And I said to Dave one day, I said, do you know what? It's really good to understand, to project where you think you are at the top of the market. You know, everybody tries to judge when buy low, sell high, you know, and of course, nobody ever knows when low is or when high is. But we were at the point where we said, look, everybody else is copying what we're doing. We're not going to be that unique going forward. So everybody wants to buy this company. Maybe now's the time to do that. And we both agreed, and Universal and a whole bunch of others were knocking on the door. Of course,
I bet.
All the company, Motown was acquired at that point. Geffen Records was acquired at that point. A&M Records was by, even Arista was acquired. So they were coming to GRP. So we said, yes, let's take advantage of the market. And as you said, I stayed on as the CEO and president and ran the company for another 5 years. And it gave me the opportunity with Universal. They had this great catalog of Impulse records, of Decca records, of Chess records. So it was everything from these old Ramsey Lewis recordings to, you know, all the great blues artists, all the way through people like John Coltrane, certainly all the great Impulse recordings that were there, as well as Louis Armstrong and Sarah and Ella and all these recordings. And I had the opportunity to reimagine these records and put them in together and CDs and issue them. So for me, it was like, you know, I was a kid in the candy shop. I was having a great old time.
So were jazz DJs all over the country just to have the new tech form of this great American music, whether it was the blues or great mainstream jazz or contemporary jazz, a phenomenal time for you. Our guest today is Mr. Larry Rosen, and we will be continuing in conversation with him, and we'll come up to 2008 when he starts South Florida's most successful jazz series. Stay with us here on South Florida Arts Beat. Welcome back to South Florida Arts Beat. Hello, Ed Bell with you. Later on the program, you'll hear Chef Norman Van Aken's A Word on Food and our arts calendar with Deborah Margold, Deputy Director of the Miami-Dade County Department of Cultural Affairs. Now, we return to the conversation with our country's premier jazz presenter, Mr. Larry Rosen, to touch on his seventh season of Jazz Roots at the Arsht Center, featuring six unique and diverse programs starting this coming November 7th through April 24th, 2015. And we're back with our guest, Mr. Larry Rosen, and we want to go back to 2008 when Larry created Jazz Roots, a Larry Rosen jazz series, a concert and educational program created for the performing arts centers all over the country. It started out, we're proud, we're honored to be able to say, at the Adrian Arsht Center right here in Miami, Florida. How did this idea develop, Larry, and how did it come into fruition that first year? I'm sure it wasn't easy.
Oh, and it wasn't. You know, it was the Arsht Center was just built at that particular point, and they were looking for programming, and there was an interim CEO at that particular point named Larry Wilka, who I knew from the Kennedy Center because he was there for many, many years, and with GRP we used to do a lot of shows in D.C. And he said, look, I understand you live here in Miami, and, you know, who would be better than you to put a jazz series on here? And I said, are you kidding? Do you think we're going to sell 2,000 seats with a jazz series in Miami? I mean, I know the history of jazz here and selling records here, and it's, you know,
it's
if
rough.
You could sell 400 tickets, you're good. Mm-hmm. Never mind 2,000 for a show. And he said, well, why don't you give it a shot? We're looking for programming. And I thought about it a lot, and I said, we have to do something really special. We have to create a brand, and that was the whole Jazz Roots concept came about. It wasn't a matter of just putting up artist names and getting a whole bunch of people to come, because it wouldn't work. So I decided we needed something organic to connect to the community. By the way, I never thought about this going to other cities. I was designing something for Miami. I was living here about 7 years at that particular point, so I had some sense of what this whole community was about. And I said, look, the Drums from Africa is the musical DNA that connect all of the Americas, not just the United States, but also the Caribbean countries and also Brazilian music. And it was really the horrible time of slavery when all these Africans were brought to the New World, and bringing the music and the heritage and the culture and certainly the rhythms and all these concepts of life force music to a new world. And that was kind of then embraced by people who were here and making their own versions of it and taking these elements and putting them together in various ways. Needless to say, in Brazil, that became the basis for samba and ultimately bossa nova, and the same thing in Cuba, Puerto Rico. It became the music that became all Latin music that we all know, ultimately into salsa, but it was rumba and certainly mambo and cha-cha-cha and so on. And in the United States, it was the basis for gospel music and blues and jazz and all the way to hip-hop, you know. So there's a gigantic history here that's really unique to America to put all these elements together. And I figured the makeup of this community is really that DNA. So if we have jazz roots and we look back at that connective tissue, it brings the whole community together. So that's what it'll be called, and that's what it's thematically going to be all based on. And we have to have an education program because we got to bring in young people and get them to understand the history here and how it all works and how it's connected. And then we also have to have thematic shows, shows around concepts and themes that fit with this overall umbrella idea of what music should all be about and how it's presented. And we have to bring in world-class, the greatest artists in the world, and be presented in a way that when audiences come in, they're going to just love what they're seeing. And ultimately, from the first show on, every show, as you know, has sold out. It's been really totally amazing.
It's remarkable.
It is remarkable.
Now, that was 2008. Your Jazz Roots series gets its start at the Arts Center here in Miami. Now it's spread throughout the country. To where?
Well, I mean, what happened was right after we did this here, all these performing arts centers speak to each other, and they're all trying to look for programming, and they're all trying to see where does jazz fit into, you know, the entire culture and the environment. And I start getting calls from, first it started in Dallas, Texas, then it was Indiana, then it was Las Vegas, then it was Atlanta, Georgia. What are you doing in Miami, and why is this working, you know? Could you come and speak to us? So I'd go and I'd speak to them in these various cities, and they had beautiful performing arts centers. And some of them tried jazz before and it didn't work. Some of them were brand new performing arts centers and they were looking for new concepts. And I just brought the same thematic idea, but put it together for each community individually, because each one is somewhat unique, you know?
Right.
And we created a Jazz Roots committee, an advisory committee in every city. So it was members of the local NPR station, the PBS station, the Boards of Education, the universities, the musicians, you know, the movers and shakers. And in each city, they became a great evangelist for what this was all about. And it kept building and building and building. So from there, it just keeps going.
What a success. Did I hear it's also in Orlando?
Orlando is opening up a brand new performing arts center, which is going to open actually in November of 2014. And I got a call from them, and they said, we heard about what's happening in Miami. Could you come here and present this concert series, Jazz Roots, here in Orlando? And I was just there just the other day with a meeting with them and talking about how we're going to launch this and how it's all going to work. And the first show will start there in November.
You are a godsend for jazz in so many different ways through the decades. Larry, we have just under 5 minutes, and you all have recently announced the 2014-2015 Jazz Roots press release. And if we can dance from event to event, I'm sure it will be delightful. November 7th, 2014, you have a great show called Georgia on My Mind. Guess who it celebrates?
Ray Charles.
Tell us about the list.
I mean, Ray Charles, look, I don't care who you are and what you like. Ray Charles is one of the most unique performers and artists in the world has ever known. I mean, you know, if there's Mozart, there's Ray Charles. Yeah, I mean, Ray Charles is just one of a kind. And he embodied so much of what we talk about jazz roots. You know, what is it all about? Where does it come from? And that real kind of core emotional connection to music. So, you know, Ray Charles is wonderful. And we put together this show to honor Ray Charles, not to try to imitate him, but to honor the music. And on the show, we have Take Six, great group that has all these gospel and jazz background, and you know they're Sons of the South, is the same way that Ray Charles was. Clint Holmes, who's an Emmy Award winner, who's appeared in concerts all around the world. Nina Freelon, one of the great jazz vocalists. Kirk Whalum, one of the great saxophone players. We have a big band, and it's led here by Shelley Berg, you know, from our own dean from the University of Miami and the Frost School of Music. and with a big band, and we have the Mass Gospel Choir from right here in Miami to do the, you know, the gospel roots that connect to all these songs like What I Say and all these great classics. And we've already presented the show a couple of times around the country, and it's been a smash hit.
I'm sure.
Very exciting show.
That's the opener, November 7th. We move on to December 19th and a presentation called Celebration, featuring your dear friend on your TV show.
That's right, Ramsey Lewis. I mean, the one and only Ramsey Lewis, the in crowd. And Ramsey is going to be here, and we're going to be celebrating the holiday season with Christmas songs and holiday songs in a funky and soulful way. And also on the show is Gregory Porter, who's one of those young new guys who was just coming on the scene. He just won a Grammy Award for the best jazz vocalist this past year, and this guy's exploding all over the country.
He's superb. Now, January 9th, the Jazz Roots series continues with an evening with Arturo Sandoval and friends. Wow.
Well, Arturo, you know, everybody knows.
Miami Homecoming.
Miami Homecoming, and I feel so connected to Arturo because when he came from Cuba to the United States and he was looking for a record deal, I signed him for GRP.
So that Bravo.
Was and when the first record we did was called Flight to Freedom.
Yeah.
And it was all about Arturo, you know, in his career and his great musicianship. We made lots and lots of records together, won Grammy Awards and so on.
That's the vision I'm talking about.
And and he's going to have a lot of guests on this show. He's bringing his homeboys here too. So we'll have Willie Chirino on the show, I mean, which is going to be an incredible show. I mean, they've done so much together. And so many other great artists are going to be on this with a big band, and there's going to be a lot of surprises that we're discussing right now that we'll tell as we get closer.
Now, for Black History Month, February 20th, you've got a great program called Soul to Soul.
And that features Diane Reeves, you know, again, one of the greatest, probably the queen of American jazz singers today. Diana is just one of a kind. And Phil Perry, one of the great jazz soul singers, is on the show with her, too. So that's our Soul to Soul show, and that celebrates Black History Month in February.
March 20th, Jazz Meets Broadway.
That's going to be a great show because, you know, we talk about Broadway. A lot of the music that came historically through Broadway were written by, you know, George and Ira Gershwin, you could go on and on, Irving Berlin. And a lot of those songs, which became actually the American Songbook, are the classics that all jazz players play on all those songs. Even Charlie Parker wrote melodies on top of those great, you know, standard songs. So we're going to be celebrating that with Michael Feinstein, which is, you know, he's one of the greats when it comes to understanding the American Songbook and Broadway. And Christine Abasol, who's one of the great stars of Broadway, will be on that show with us. And the Henry Mancini Institute Orchestra, the whole 80-piece orchestra, and it's going to be just an incredible night of Broadway and jazz.
You wrap up Jazz Roots April 24th, 2015, with Jazz Appreciation Month and jazz legends, two of my favorites.
Al Jarreau and David Sanborn. Now, come on. I mean, it's as good as it gets.
So, an exquisite new season for Jazz Roots, a Larry Rosen jazz series taking place, of course, at the Adrian Arsht Center right here in Miami. If you're traveling throughout the country, perhaps you want to stop in Carmel, Indiana, Dallas, Texas, Orlando, and see their versions of Jazz Roots. And Larry Rosen, it's always an honor to have you join us. Our time is always, unfortunately, too brief, but thank you so much for joining us again on South Florida Arts Beat. All the success to you in the world, sir.
Well, thank you, Ed. It's a pleasure to be here, and I feel like I'm home right here. Thank you for everything.
And once again, that's the 7th annual Jazz Roots, a Larry Rosen jazz series presented by Wells Fargo at the Arsht Center starting this November 7th through April 24th, 2015. For more information, go to arshtcenter.org or call 305-949-6722. You can also go to larryrosen.com or jazzroots.net. Please stay with us. South Florida Arts Beat will continue in just a moment. Mid-South Florida Arts Beat here on 91.3 WLRN and 91.5 WKWM. Hello, Ed Bell with you. Coming up later on the program, Chef Norman Van Aken cooks up A Word on Food, and our arts calendar features Deborah Margol, Deputy Director of the Miami-Dade County Department of Cultural Affairs. Now, music contributor Chris DeAngelis interviews a renowned jazz bassist about his career and his upcoming concert for the South Florida Jazz Series.
In jazz music, the upright bass has singular capabilities. It simultaneously provides rhythmic pulse, outlines harmony, and in freer musical situations, feeds melodic material to the other instruments in the group. The bass provides a solid ground over which melody and improvisation can soar, and only the bass performs all three of these functions within a jazz group. Considering the unique status of this instrument as the glue which binds an ensemble together, one would expect to find many bass-playing band leaders. While it's been said that jazz music is democracy in a microcosm, with every member of the band standing on equal ground, every democracy still needs a president, a leader who can guide the group's musical direction, and well, there just haven't been too many bass player presidents. With the exceptions of Charles Mingus, who was more of a dictator than a president, and Ron Carter, who was eminently more diplomatic, bassists as band leaders have traditionally been quite rare. However, thanks to developments in the electronic amplification of the instrument, the codification of jazz within the American educational system, and perhaps most importantly, thanks to the continuing evolution of jazz itself, more and more bass players have emerged from the shadows of the rhythm section to lead their own bands in recent years. This inevitably brings us to Christian McBride. McBride grew up in a musical family in Philadelphia. His father, Lee Smith, is a professional bassist who performed with Afro-Cuban percussionist Mongo Santa Maria, Dizzy Gillespie, Rashawn Roland Kirk, Bud Shank, and others. And McBride's great uncle was a bass player too. He began playing bass guitar at the age of 9 and picked up acoustic 2 years later. When he was around 14 or 15, he met trumpeter Wynton Marsalis, who became somewhat of a mentor. At that time, McBride was undecided whether to pursue classical music or jazz, and Marsalis, whose own star was on the rise, helped convince him jazz was the way. By the age of 17, he was in New York, attending the prestigious Juilliard School of Music. At that time, he also had joined saxophonist Bobby Watson's group. He attended Juilliard for only 1 year before he left the school to concentrate all of his energies on his professional musical career. Later, in New York, while still a teenager, the young bass prodigy began a 3-year stint with trumpeter Freddie Hubbard. He soon became the bassist favored by older jazz legends like Milt Jackson, J.J. Johnson, Benny Golson, and Hank Jones, as well as his own contemporaries like Roy Hargrove and Joshua Redman. Since then, it's become nearly impossible to find a jazz artist he hasn't gigged with. Herbie Hancock, Pat Metheny, Chick Corea, Roy Haynes, Joe Henderson, McCoy Tyner, John McLaughlin. Well, we really don't have enough time here to list them all. But like all truly great musicians, McBride has not been deterred by labels and definitions. He is equally at home in pop and R&B music, and for the past 20 years, he's recorded and performed with an astonishing array of artists like Isaac Hayes, Paul McCartney, The Roots, Sting, Queen Latifah, Questlove, Celine Dion, James Brown. All in all, he has appeared on over 300 recordings as a sideman. Christian McBride became a bandleader in his own right way back in 1995 with the debut of his first album, Gettin' to It. Since then, he's released a dozen albums. His music and the bands which he fronts are refreshing and unpredictable, running the gamut from bebop to funk, big band swing, blues, soul, and hip-hop, sometimes within a single performance. Christian McBride and his trio will be in South Florida next Saturday night, June 14th, at the Mineachi Performing Arts Center at Nova University in Davie. The trio is touring in support of their new CD entitled Out Here. We recently spoke with Christian McBride about his life, his instrument, and his music. Christian McBride, welcome to South Florida Arts Beat.
My pleasure.
Your father is a bassist. What kind of advice has he given you on playing the instrument?
I don't know if he really gave me any advice. He just taught me how to play my first couple of songs, which were, some old R&B classics like Papa Was a Rolling Stone and, let's see, when I first started playing bass, Hall & Oates' I Can't Go For That was like the number one pop song, so that was the other song I learned. So, that kind of just got me started. After that, it was all like listening to the radio, listening to records, and doing all I could to learn the bass line directly from the recording.
So when you first began playing, you were mostly listening to what was happening then?
Yeah, it was all popular music and my mother's old R&B records.
Yeah, I noticed on a lot of your CDs you include at least one 60s or 70s R&B tune.
Oh, yeah.
How about Ray Brown?
I didn't really become familiar with Ray Brown until my late teens. By the time I discovered the Oscar Peterson Trio, I was about maybe 16 or 17. And needless to say, I fell in love with it right away. And then once I moved to New York from Philadelphia, and particularly when I started working with Benny Green, the great pianist, he was and still is, a Oscar Peterson historian and protege. So once I started playing with Benny, I really kind of got headfirst into the Oscar Peterson Trio. Therefore, I started getting into Ray Brown pretty heavy. And then not too long after that, I met him, and he became a mentor and probably my number one biggest hero on the bass.
Wow. Hey, did you go to public school?
In Philly, yes, I did. I went to the High School for the Creative and Performing Arts, which is also where the Roots went. That's where Joey DeFrancesco went. That's where Kurt Rosenwinkel went. We all graduated together, same year, class of 89.
They must have had a great music program going there.
Well, you know, I have it. I need to hurry up and transfer it quickly before it fades away, but I actually have an old VHS tape of us in high school. My high school jazz band's rhythm section was me, Questlove, Joey, and Kurt Rosenwinkel. And I have a videotape of us all playing together in high school. I got to get that digitized so everybody can see it.
Yeah, get that baby up on YouTube, man. I know a lot of people want to see that. How did the program there inform your decision about making music your life?
You know, I think I was fortunate. I knew that I wanted to be a musician for the rest of my life before I got to high school. I think once I started playing the bass in middle school, I fell in love with it so deeply. I knew that's what I wanted to do for the rest of my life. So, you know, I feel like once you discover what it is that you love, that's more than half the battle. Because once you figure that out, then you just work on that, and then I think that will take you places you wouldn't even have dreamt of going.
So when you met Wynton Marsalis, was that high school or junior high school?
Yeah. Yeah, that was high school, yeah.
And what did he have to say to you?
You know, it's funny because in retrospect, I was 15. Wynton was probably only 26. And we don't acknowledge 26-year-olds as having a lot of wisdom, but I think Wynton had a lot of wisdom at age 26. He was able to help me focus on exactly what I needed to do, particularly as a jazz bassist. And I just kept doing what I was already doing, but just even more intensely, listening to a lot of records, doing a lot of transcribing, paying attention to every note that all of these great bass players played on every recording I could get my hands on, from Ray Brown to Paul Chambers to Ron Carter to Mingus, Jimmy Garrison. I just really did all I could to really focus on becoming a really good jazz bass player. So by the time I got to New York, I could hopefully be in line to start working right away. And fortunately, that's sort of what happened.
Out Here is your 12th album as a band leader. How do you go about organizing things when you're running a band?
It depends. If you keep the same band all the time and play with the same guys all the time, I'm not saying that there's anything wrong with that, because, I mean, that's great too, but you get to learn from a whole lot of different musicians and get to experience a lot of different things when you put together all these different groups. So in the last, particularly the last, I would say, 6 or 7 years, you know, I've had the Trio, I've had Inside Straight, I've had a big band.
Yeah.
I've had my experimental electric group. So, again, you know, it kind of all depends on whatever I'm trying to accomplish with that particular band, you know. With my Trio, which has been my main group for the last couple of years now, it was sort of an offshoot of my Inside Straight quintet. Carl Allen and Peter Martin have been the rhythm section for Inside Straight pretty much since its touring inception in 2009. And then there was a time where Peter and Carl couldn't make particular gigs, and then I would call Ulysses Owen Jr. and Christian Sands in the sub. And as fate would have it, Warren Wolf and Steve Wilson, who rounded out the Inside Straight group, there were a couple of gigs that they couldn't make. So instead of replacing the both of them, I just opted to do those particular shows only as a trio. And I found out that we had a little thing happening. So I decided, well, maybe I should just keep this trio together. And that's how it all works. Christian, he just turned 25. Ulysses Owens was 31. they do a lot of projects with a lot of guys their age, and none of them really play like real in the pocket right down the middle straight ahead. So I thought that it would be good for them to do that in my trio, because I know they're not going to get to do that anywhere else. So I want them to be able to learn how to express themselves fully in this particular setting, and they do an awesome job.
That's cool. Well, we're all looking forward to your show over at Nova University.
Well, I'm just glad to make it down to South Florida again. You know, there was a long time, actually through most of the 90s and the early part of the 2000s, you know, I didn't get to South Florida much. Now, this is like, what, my fifth or sixth gig down there, like in the last 3 years, and I can't get down there enough. I appreciate the love I'm getting from South Florida. I hope it doesn't stop.
Well, thanks for bringing it down here. Christian McBride, thank you very much for being on South Florida Arts Beat.
My pleasure.
You can hear Christian McBride and his trio live in concert next Saturday evening, June 14th, at the Rose and Alfred Miniacci Performing Arts Center on the campus of Nova University in Davie. For tickets and more info, go to southfloridajazz.org. And for more information about the man himself, go to christianmcbride.com. This is Chris DeAngelis for South Florida Arts Beat.
Chris DeAngelis is a songwriter and musician who has performed throughout the state over the past 20 years in many musical genres. You can email him at molemachine1@yahoo.com. That's MOLEMACHINE and the number 1@yahoo.com. Please keep your dial set right here to 91.3 WLRN and 91.5 WKWM. South Florida Arts Beat returns in just a moment. Welcome back to South Florida Arts Beat here on 91.3 WLRN and 91.5 WKWM. Ed Bell with you. And now, Chef Norman Van Aken gives us a word on food.
I don't want French fried potatoes, red ripe tomatoes. I'm never satisfied. I want the frim-fram sauce with the offs and fade, with shafafa on the side.
Hi, I'm Norman Van Aken, and welcome to A Word on Food. Today's word on food is caviar. You don't eat caviar because you're hungry, but the portion set before us at a dinner the other night was certainly capable of staving off a serious quantity of pang. We all eyed the curvaceous morsels of edible hedonism. They were caviar-stuffed chive-tied crepes, perched upon the base of empty, overturned, long-stemmed Riedel wine glasses. This caviar presentation was done in the style of the legendary Beggar's Purses as created by Chef Barry Wine, the once-upon-a-gilded-time owner of the Quilted Giraffe restaurant of New York City. I'd heard Chef Wine used to insist that his guests used no hands, nor even forks or spoons when eating the caviar-plumped purse. He also, it has been told, favored taking pictures of some of his clientele who were instructed to put on elegantly designed handcuffs he had created by a Manhattan artisan for these moments of divine decadence. The mode d'emploi, he instructed, had the guests leaning way over, face first, with their arms cuffed behind them, taking said purse between their lips and then, standing upright, consuming the luxurious cargo within the dainty crepe. I did not wait for anyone's insisting on such from me. I picked up my beggar's purse with one hand and enjoyed it tremendously, had a gulp of champagne with the other, 1995 Krug, by the way, and finished it, followed by some more of the Krug. In the movie Titanic, there is the one dining scene where the action hero, Jack Dawson, played by Leonardo DiCaprio, is allowed to dine with the first-class guests, which include his gorgeous new love interest, Rose, her driven mother, her lousy fiancé, a few other dandies, and the woman known as the unsinkable Molly Brown. Miss Brown helps young Jack overcome the hostile snobbery being directed at him. He sees a half dozen pieces of cutlery on each side of his plate, and his eyes start to swim. The caviar service begins, and she whispers, "Just start from the outside and work your way in." The mother of pearl spoon is in front of him, and he, instead, waves off the waiter, bearing the beluga, uttering, "I don't like caviar." Jack sank a boatload of my respect. Sturgeon have been in the waters of the earth for over 250 million years. It is not clear when people first created and consumed what became known as caviar, but its first written record was from the time of Batu Khan, the grandson of Genghis Khan, in the 1240s. Local rulers by the Volga River employed sturgeon masters. Sturgeon is the largest fish to enter fresh water. The beluga variety of sturgeon is a fish that is at least 20 years old before the roe are harvested. That is much larger than the other prized varieties, which include Ocetra, Golden Ocetra, and Sevruga. The beluga sturgeon can attain a weight of 2,500 pounds at that age, of which 10% is roe. Ka-ching! Greed and insensitive resource management nearly crushed caviar, but times have changed somewhat for the better. It is a matter of personal taste which is better in regards to the varieties, but malasal is a must to most, a term meaning little salt. The presence of salt preserves caviar, but masks the flavors. World-class caviar should be served as simply as possible. Forget chopped eggs, capers, and onions. Handcuffs, though, are optional. I'm Norman Van Aken, and that's my word on food.
Norman Van Aken is the author of the memoir, No Experience Necessary, The Culinary Odyssey of Norman Van Aken. Please tune in tomorrow morning at 8:34 on Weekend Edition to hear Indian Food. And here's our South Florida Arts Beat Entertainment Calendar. And today we welcome back Deborah Margold, Deputy Director of the Miami-Dade County Department of Cultural Affairs. Deborah, fresh back from the Berkshires.
I am indeed, and happy to have been up and eager, hopefully, to get back up there over the summer. However, we have a great weekend, I mean, crazy wonderful weekend this weekend. So I'm just going to launch right in, beginning with tonight and tomorrow night at the Adrian Arsch Center in the Ziff Ballet Opera House. They're presenting Ballet Hispanico, is a wonderful dance company under the direction of artistic director Eduardo Villaro, and the program they're performing will feature works by Villaro himself, as well as a world premiere by Miami's own dance luminary Rosie Herrera. It is beautiful. Definitely check them out at the Ziff Ballet Opera House at the Arts Center. That's tonight and tomorrow night at 8 p.m. It's also the final weekend of Area Stage Company's presentation of the show titled Title of the Show, and that's down at their Coral Gables Theater at 1560 South Dixie Highway, tonight and tomorrow night at 8 p.m. and Sunday at 7 p.m. at Area Stage Company on South Dixie Highway. Also this weekend, we have the third annual Miami Underwater Festival that's being presented by the Patricia and Philip Frost Museum of Science. This whole Underwater Festival is a celebration of Global World Oceans Day. So on Saturday, they're going to have all of their events at the Frost Museum of Science at the South Miami Avenue location, right near downtown. And all of the events at the festival are going to be free with a paid museum admission. However, on Sunday, they're going to present all of the festival activities at the Knight Plaza, which is adjacent to the new Frost Museum of Science, which is under construction, as we all know, and are all watching with eager anticipation, right next door to the Paris Art Museum Miami, right in downtown at 1103 Biscayne Boulevard. So this will be the first time that guests can access the Knight Plaza and sort of take sneak peek photos of the progress of the new museum. It's really going to be fun to be on site. And if you haven't had an opportunity yet to go to Museum Park and enjoy these two museums, one that's open and one that will be open in a not too distant future, what a great excuse to get down there and check it out. So it's the third annual Miami Underwater Festival. Opening next Thursday and running through July 6th, it's, of course, Summer Shorts time, City Theater's incredibly hysterical and provocative Summer Shorts Festival, and it will be in the Carnival Studio Theater at the Arsch Center. Summer Shorts is America's short play festival, and so it's probably the most fun you can have in 90 minutes. Certainly, it's the most theater you can cram into 90 minutes, so it's a ton of fun. Go check out Summer Shorts at the Adrian Arsch Center, presented by City Theater. This Sunday at the Coral Gables Art Cinema, they are featuring a Cuban-American made-in-Miami thriller called Paraíso, and they're going to have on-site the director of the film as well as the lead actor, and this is a really special, extraordinary screening as part of Miami Film Month at Coral Gables Art Cinema this Sunday at 1 p.m. Also this Sunday, I told you it was a busy weekend. Mm-hmm. Also this Sunday, we have Orchestra Miami performing in what I think is a really cool idea. They have a program called Discover Miami Through Music, where they are presenting concerts in Miami's most interesting and historic landmarks. And this Sunday's is at the Miami Scottish Rite Temple, right off of downtown at 471 Northwest 3rd Street. Here's a great opportunity to go. Here's an all Mozart program at the Masonic Temple, and that's this Sunday at 4 p.m. Also this weekend is a performance at the Adrian R. Center Carnival Studio Theater through Zoetic Stage, a production of The Great God Pan. This is an Amy Herzog play. The story really explores how one's life and relationships can be thrown into turmoil, but it's less about abuse and more about memory and self-discovery, and it's just a really powerful, beautiful, another triumph from Amy Herzog. And that's on stage at the Carnival Studio Theater at the Arts Center this weekend through Sunday. We also have the closing weekend at the Actors Playhouse in Coral Gables of Scott and Hem in the Garden of Allah. And this story imagines an encounter between two literary titans, F. Scott Fitzgerald and Ernest Hemingway, in 1937. So it's tonight and tomorrow at 8 p.m., Sunday at 3 p.m. at Actors Playhouse in Coral Gables. The Perez Art Museum has in its galleries selections from the Sackner Archive of Concrete and Visual Poetry, celebrated Haitian artist and local icon Edouard Duval Carrier's Imagined Landscapes, Caribbean Crossroads of the World, and Image Search photography from the collection. They also have works by Jed Novat in the Sculpture Garden, all at the Perez Art Museum in downtown Miami. The Bass Museum of Art is featuring vessels from the collection, Vanitas Fashion and Art, and Gravity and Grace, Monumental Works by El Anatsui. And the Jewish Museum of Florida, FIU, on South Beach is featuring Growers, Grocers, and Gefilte Fish, a gastronomic look at Florida's Jews and food, as well as Cinema Judaica, The War Years, 1939 to 1949. And for more information about these and everything else going on in town, please check out miamidadearts.org. That's miamidadearts, all one word, .org. And you see a new look on our website, so enjoy that, too. We're pretty proud of it.
Deborah Margol, Deputy Director of the Miami-Dade County Department of Cultural Affairs. Deborah, thank you so much for all of those events.
Enjoy the weekend and all of the summer activities.
Great weekend to you. Bye-bye.
Thanks.
Caribbean Jazz Mataz takes place this Sunday, June 8th at 7 o'clock at the Broward Center's Amaturo Theater in Fort Lauderdale, featuring Jamaica's First Lady of Jazz, Myrna Haig, Richie Stevens, Eugene Gray, Charmaine Ford, and George Tandy. For more info, call 800-382-7441 or go to CaribCastTV.tv, CaribCastTV. And in Coconut Grove, this month's Fam Night, fashion and art and music will have a special emphasis on music as Fête de la Musique joins the monthly arts event tomorrow, Saturday the 7th in Coconut Grove. Musicians will be spread throughout the grove, and as you stroll from gallery to gallery, you'll come upon all sorts of musical genres, all free throughout the center grove. And the Grove's own drum circle will meet on the corner of Commodore Plaza and Grand Avenue. You can join them. There are always extra drums, seats, and even hula hoops. Admission is free and open to the public that Saturday at 7 in Coconut Grove. We'll rebroadcast South Florida Arts Beat tonight and every Friday night at 7 o'clock on our WLRN Extra HD channel. You can tune in on your HD radio or go to our website at WLRN.org for more information. That's today's edition of South Florida Arts Beat. We hope you enjoyed the show. I'm Ed Bell, producer and host. Our theme was composed by Mike Levine and performed by Mike and Sam Levine. Paul Leary is our online producer. Thanks to our technical director today, Andy Wagner, and our contributors, Chris DeAngelis, Norman Van Aken, and Deborah Margol. Call us with your comments or event information, 305-995-2258. You can fax us your event info to 305-995-2221 or email it to us at info@WLRN.org. We'd like to hear from you. Monday at this time, Topical Currents with hosts Joseph Cooper and Bonnie Berman, Monday at 1 o'clock. Have yourself a great weekend, and please keep your dial set right here to 91.3 WLRN and 91.5 WKWM. Until next time, this is Ed Bell saying bye-bye. Enjoy.